You know, names are sometimes used to identify people with particular traits or for what they're often remembered by. For example, if I use the term Honest Abe, you know that that is referring to Abraham Lincoln. He was, again, reportedly one of the most honest individuals while he ran his law practice in Illinois before he became president of the United States. There's also a name that is familiar to some in U.S. history, and that is Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold left the Continental Army of the United States to join the British. He'd actually been one of George Washington's closest advisors. George Washington had full trust in him, actually put him in charge of West Point. But Benedict Arnold is known as a traitor. And so sometimes if you're having an argument with somebody or they do something you don't like, you say, you're just a Benedict Arnold. You're telling them that they're a traitor. Of course, it's not reduced just to individuals, again, throughout history. It's also, we find in the pages of our Bible. Barnabas is known as the son of encouragement. He is known as an encourager. If one was to be saying, you're just like Barnabas, you would be telling that individual that they are an encourager. Or you might go up to someone and say, you're just a Nabal. Now, some of you are giggling because you already know who that is, but Nabal was the husband of Abigail, or David would take her as his wife. And that word Nabal in the Hebrew means fool. And if you read the story of Nabal, he lived up to his name. So rather than call somebody a fool, you're just saying, oh, you're just a Nabal. Judas, go to someone and say, oh, you're a Judas. That's a reference to Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus. Betray somebody, and you would refer to them as a Judas. There's an apostle that is given a moniker that is used to this very day. That apostle goes by the name Ptolemy Didymus. We know that moniker as Doubting Thomas. If someone is in doubt, or they doubt what you say or what happened or what occurred, you often reply, well, you're just a Doubting Thomas. But is that a fair assessment of Thomas? Is that truly a fair assessment? Let's explore Thomas and see what the Bible says about him this afternoon in this split sermon. The title for the message is Lessons from the Life of Thomas. Lessons from the Life of Thomas. You know, we don't have a lot in terms of what is recorded concerning Thomas. But it's interesting in what we do have, it's very meaningful, and there are lessons that we can glean from just the little bit that we have recorded of this particular disciple, this particular apostle. We understand and realize that there are those that were more noteworthy, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, again, James, Peter. We also understand Paul. Those individuals are very well known, but Thomas was an individual who was an apostle, but he is perhaps not as well known or not as written about as much in the pages of the Bible. We do know that he was perhaps a twin, because in the Bible he is referred to as Thomas Didymus, Didymus meaning the twin. So it's possible that he was a twin. We know that Thomas was a loyal and he was an honest individual. His story, again, while brief, shows a constant and a consistency in terms of being a loyal follower of Jesus Christ. Now, the history of Thomas after the death of Jesus Christ and after we go through the book of Acts, again, moving forward in history, that after the apostles went out and after they scattered sometime after 31 AD forward, that we don't have a lot, but history seems to record, although it's sketchy, that Thomas died a martyr's death in what would now be considered the nation or the country of India. Now, again, whether that's true or not, we don't know. Records are sketchy, but some say that he died by spear in the side. Again, there's an irony to that because one of the passages that we're going to read is the interaction that he had with Christ when Christ told him to put his hand in his side where the soldier had thrust the spear in Christ's side. Again, those records are sketchy. We don't know if that's just sort of fable or what has come down through time of what people believed happened or occurred. We don't simply know. But one thing is true. We understand what we do know about Thomas is that, as I said before, he was a consistent and he was a loyal follower of Jesus Christ. So let's take a look first of all at, we're going to take a look at three scenes that show us Thomas and his life in this little bit that we have recorded in the Bible. So let's take a look at scene one. We find that in John chapter 14. John chapter 14, again, is a passage of Scripture that we often read at the time of Passover, after we get done with the bread and the wine, after we again read those meaningful words of Jesus Christ, after he would literally, hours after he spoke these words, be led away, being arrested, tried, and crucified. But notice here, John chapter 14, beginning in verse 1, he says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you." Now, again, understand and realize that what's happening and occurring here, and their eyes are all riveted. The disciples' eyes are all riveted on him as he's speaking these words. He's talking about going away. He's talking about, let not your heart be troubled. Verse 3, "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may also, that you may be also. Verse 4, "And where I go, you know, and the way you know." So he's speaking these words saying, where I'm going to go, you know where that's at, and you know the way. Who is the person that speaks up here? Verse 5, "Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way?" So here we find the first sort of interaction of consequence or meaning with regards to Thomas. It's interesting that the other disciples kept quiet. But when Jesus spoke these words that we read here in verses 1 through 4 about the way and where I'm going, you know the way and you know where I am going and what the way is, he said, how can we know that? We don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Thomas wanted clarification. You know, it's interesting when you think about people that sometimes when something is said or something is stated, oftentimes people sit in silence. They just don't say anything. They sort of try to figure it out for themselves. Now, part of that can be out of fear. They don't want to be the one to say, I have a question. They don't want to be the one, well, that's a stupid question. Why did you ask the question? But here we find an indication that Thomas was not shy in asking. He was not hesitant. He wanted to know, what do you mean? Now, you can say, well, that's doubt. Well, no, that's not doubt. He's wanting clarification. You're saying that we know where you're going. You're saying that we know the way, but how can we know that? You're speaking these words. You're telling us not to be troubled, but you're talking in terms that we don't really clearly understand what it is. Again, he was not hesitant. He wanted to know what Jesus meant. Jesus didn't rebuke him. Notice what he says in verse 6. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So here we find the first scene from Thomas's life. And here we find the individual simply not being shy, not being hesitant. Their master, their teacher, the one that they had been following for these 3.5 years, he suddenly makes a statement. And rather than suffering in silence, not understanding, trying to guess what Jesus meant, he says, I got a question. What do you mean by that? Explain what you mean by that. Help us understand that. Let's move to the second scene in Thomas's life. We find that over in John chapter 11. Let's go over there just a couple of pages, John chapter 11. John chapter 11. And again, as I said before, there are three scenes that we're going to look at. This is the second scene with regards to interaction specifically with Thomas. Now again, we remember it from the standpoint that Thomas is referred to as doubting Thomas. Now when you think of doubt, what's the first thing that comes to mind? You think of someone doubts, sometimes they fear. They doubt because they fear. I don't want to do something because I fear the following is going to happen. I doubt that God says that he will do the following. But was that actually doubt that Thomas had? Notice John chapter 11 beginning in verse 1. This is again, we're going to find the death of Lazarus. And Thomas plays a role in this, and we've probably read this story before and you may have read over it. John chapter 11, beginning in verse 1, he says, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.'" Now, they don't have phones, they don't have internet, they don't have cell phones, they can't text each other. So this has to be a situation in which there's got to be a messenger or somebody sending a message in order for it to get to Jesus, wherever he's at, because he's not there at Bethany. So they're trying to get him the message, "You need to come. He's sick." This is obviously going to take some time. Verse 4, "When Jesus heard that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" Now, again, we know the rest of the story. We understand exactly what it was that Jesus was saying. Now, as he's making that statement, obviously, if the disciples are hearing this, they're not really sure what that means. Well, what is he talking about? Verse 5, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was." You see John's writing here, and it seems rather strange, right? If you're thinking, you know, I get a call from you, "My husband's in the hospital. They said he literally is not going to make it through the night. I'll get with you about 3 days from now." It doesn't make sense unless you go back and you read verse 4, because it says, "The sickness is unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of Man may be glorified through it." There was going to be a teaching lesson as an end result of the death of Lazarus. But the disciples don't know that. All they know is this messenger has given Jesus the note, "Lazarus is coming to die, he needs you." And he says, "Well, we're going to stay another 48 hours here. We're not going anywhere." Verse 7. "Then after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let us go to Judea again.' The disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?'" In other words, Jesus, this is a hot zone. The Pharisees are there. They are seeking to stone you. They're looking to kill you. Let's go back for a moment. Hold your place here. Let's go back a page, John chapter 10 and verse 24. Here we find, again, Jesus interacting with the Pharisees, interacting with the people. John chapter 10, notice verse 24. It says, "Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, 'How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly.'" Now, all of this is happening prior to what we have just read in John chapter 11, okay? So keep that in mind in terms of our timeline. "Jesus answered them, 'I told you, and you did not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me, but you do not believe because you are not of my sheep, as I said to you.'" It's a pretty powerful statement. Basically saying, you're not one of me. You're not one of my sheep. You're not one of my disciples. I've already told you this. You don't get it. "My sheep," verse 27, "hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one." That's fighting words to the Pharisees. Verse 31, "Then the Jews took up stones again." So evidently it tried to do it once before. So here John writes, they took up stones again to stone him. Now, where is all of this taking place? It's taking place in Jerusalem. Go back to John chapter 11 here for a moment. Where was it that Lazarus and Mary and Martha lived? Where was it that they were saying, come back, Lazarus is near death? It was in Bethany. It's about 2 miles, I believe, to the east of Jerusalem. So here the disciples said, we just came out of a hot zone where you made that statement, and they took the stones, they were going to kill you, and now you wait 2 days, he's probably dead, and you want to go back there? So when we read the statement that he makes here in verse 8, the disciples said to him, Rabbi, chapter 11, verse 8, the rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and you're going there again. There's probably an emphaticness about the statement they're making to him. It gets lost in the black and white on the page. Are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? Notice verse 9. Beginning back here in verse 8, the disciples made that statement. Verse 9, Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. These things he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. And a precursor, you know, if you're having a movie, that's the sort of the trailer that you're showing. There's something's going to happen here. He's dead, but he's going to be raised up. Verse 12, then his disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll not get well. If he's dead, he's dead. However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he was speaking about taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Verse 16, here's the key that I'm driving at. This is, again, scene 2. Where's Thomas in all of this? After Jesus has said all these statements, after he had said, we're going to Bethany, I've waited 2 days, now we're going, he's dead, you're going to see the glory of God again in the situation that's going to happen and occur. Let's go back. They're saying, do you sure you want to go back there? They tried to stone you last time we were within the vicinity. That's only 2 miles from Jerusalem. That's only 2 miles from the point where you almost died. Verse 16. Then Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Doesn't sound like somebody who has fear and doubt to me. He's basically saying, hey, he's laid it all out. It's Thomas who jumps up and says, let's go. Yeah, you would almost think that that would be in character for Simon Peter. Yeah, let's go, guys. Let's be the ones to go there and go and do it. But this was Thomas, doubting Thomas, as people sometimes refer to him. As I said before, so often we associate doubt with fear, but there does not seem to be any fear in Thomas's words to his fellow disciples. If he's going to die there, let's go that we would die with him too. Let's look at the third scene. The third scene we find is in John chapter 20. It's the one that we often find more fully and completely referring to or with regards to Thomas and how he came to be known with this moniker as Doubting Thomas. It's one that people often turn to say he's a doubting individual. He was a doubting disciple. Too often the moniker, as I said, or the name of Thomas is referred to as Doubting Thomas. And again, that's unfortunate because we have nowhere in the Bible that Thomas is ever referred to as Doubting Thomas. He's never referred to as Doubting Thomas. He makes a statement here in John chapter 20, and everybody just assumes, well, he's a doubting person. He didn't believe. But we've already seen through the first two scenes of his life that he was not afraid to ask questions, was he? When Jesus said, I'm going, and you know the way, and you know why I'm going, and he wanted to know, well, no, we don't know. How can we possibly know that? So we understand and realize that he had no fear of speaking up. We also understand from that second scene that we just went through that Jesus said, we're going back to Bethany, 2 miles from where the Jews had tried to stone him before, and he said, well, let's go ahead and go. So we don't see an individual here that is sort of doubting. I mean, he seems to be pretty resolved in terms of what needs to be done. But Thomas has this doubting moniker put on him as an end result of this scene, this third scene of his life that is recorded for us. Notice John chapter 20 and beginning in verse 19. John chapter 20 and verse 19. Then the same day at evening, between being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in the midst and said to them, "Peace be with you." Now, it's interesting. You know, again, we associate sometimes fear with doubt. Doubt equals fear. Fear equals doubt. But nowhere do we find the other disciples being referred to as doubtful. Did they not think that they would be protected? Did they not think that they would be taken care of? Did they not think that they would, again, have intervention from God as an end result of being his followers, being Jesus Christ's followers? No. In verse 19, very clearly, it tells us here that they were all hunkered down, for they feared the Jews. They feared the Jews. It could be said that all of them were doubtful about what was happening, and the fear of showing their faces in public. Notice verse 20. When he had said this, speaking of Jesus, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Notice the account and as it reads from John. Notice, let's read it again. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Well, why did he have to show them his hands and his side? Is it possible that they were sitting there looking at him in awe going, "Who is this?" He says, "Hey, peace, it's me. It's me." Now, it's not written there, but we have to sort of believe that he was looking at their faces, speaking of Jesus now, realizing that they were sort of dumbfounded, not sure that they believed that it was him. And he said, "Look, see, there's the nails on the stake. See my hands? See the side where the sword went in, or the spear went in? That's where I was pierced. It's me. It's me." So after they saw those things, John records it, then they were glad that they had seen when they saw the Lord. Now, again, it's important from the standpoint of reading through and understanding what was said and what happens and what occurs here. Now, again, he makes some other statements here that we won't go through, but let's drop down to verse 24 where we get the interaction now with Thomas. Verse 24, now Thomas, again called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. We don't know why Thomas was not there. There's no way for us to know. We don't know. But what's clear was that he was not there. He did not know what the rest of them knew. Verse 25, so he comes in. The other disciples therefore said to him, "We have seen the Lord." So he said to them, "Unless I see it in his hands, the print of the nails, and put my finger in the print of the nails, and put my hand in his side, I will not believe." Doubting Thomas. Now, what had happened to this particular point in terms of history, timeline? He had followed him for 3.5 years. He had gone through all that they had been through with those final teachings that he had given, literally hours that we find recorded in John. We find that, again, he would be there when he was arrested in the garden and he was taken away, when they scattered after that happened occurred. Whether he was right there at the time of the skull of Golgotha when he was crucified, or whether he was at a distance, or whether he had heard about it, whatever it was, think about the range of emotions that has to be going through someone's mind at that particular point. You've been following somebody for 3.5 years. They've been arrested. They've been led away. Your mind is just tumbling with everything that's happened and occurred after you realize your teacher of 3.5 years has been killed. You're gone from the other disciples. You walk into this room and they say, "Hey, guess who we saw? Jesus." Now, what would be going through your mind at that, with all the emotions going through your head at that particular moment in time, what would be going through your head? What's the punchline? What's the joke here, guys? This is not funny. This isn't funny. No, it's serious. We've seen him. Thomas says, unless I can see the nails, the nail prints, unless I can put my hand in his side, unless I can do exactly what you were able to do, what Jesus showed you. That's not what he says. That's the point I'm trying to make here. He did not have that benefit of Jesus showing them. My guessing here, if we're looking at this and if we're kind of discerning what is being stated here, is that when Jesus looked at the disciples, they had the same reaction that Thomas had. What? Not unless I see the holes in the hands and not unless I see the hole in the side. That's what Jesus perceived of those disciples. He knew exactly where they were going and he said, look, it's me. See? See? Thomas didn't have benefit of that. Thomas didn't have benefit of that. Verse 25, again, he makes that statement. You've got ups and downs. You've got all of these things that have happened and occurred. This angry mob, the arrest, everybody left away. The emotions are running high. Notice verse 26. Verse 26, and after 8 days, his disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, peace to you. Now, the others are going to say, it's him. It's just like we saw 8 days ago. It's the rerun, right? We saw the original. This is the rerun. We saw it. It's part two. Then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here and look at my hands and reach your hand here and put it in my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Now, this interaction that takes place between Thomas and Jesus Christ is very interesting because Thomas is the first to acknowledge Jesus as my Lord and my God. Nowhere else do we find that John, in this particular interaction, stated that the other disciples, as he said, look at the hand here, my hands, see my side, it's me. None of them said, oh, my Lord and my God. He was the first one to acknowledge Jesus as my Lord and my God. And we get that through the confirmation of what he was saying by essentially here saying, I'm all in. I know it's you. I'm all in. So what are the lessons then that we learn from Thomas? What are the lessons that we learn from Thomas? I've highlighted three that I think are important, again, from the three scenes of his life that are recorded for us here in the book of John. What's the first lesson we learn? Doubt can be used to pose a question. Doubt can be used to pose a question. Now, again, we think of doubt, we think it's wrong to doubt because that's counteractive to believe. And I'm like, not necessarily. In John chapter 14, verses 3 and 4, you don't need to go back there, but that we read that earlier, it says the following. It says, this is Jesus Christ speaking, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also, and where I am, where I go, you know, and the way you know. Thomas is posing this question to Christ, basically saying, how can we know where you're going? Was it doubt that he was going specifically to some place? No. He says, how can we know that? Remember, it is Thomas who shows the boldness in being willing to ask Jesus. I dare say that if Gallup was there running a poll of the disciples at that particular moment in time, how many of you understood the statement? They would have said, I don't understand. I don't know what he means by where I'm going. But Thomas was the one to step forward. He was the one to show the boldness. The point being here is that silent doubts rarely find answers. If we have doubts and we stay silent about that, those don't find answers. Does that mean that a person who is doubting is unbelieving? I don't believe so. Does the person who gets sick or ill and asks of God, I don't understand what's going on here. I'm trying to figure out why I continue to suffer through this sickness or illness, or why my family member or why my friend suffers through this sickness or illness. Does that mean a person does not believe? No. they have a doubt they're trying to find out. They're trying to find answers. So here in this first scene, we find a lesson from Thomas that doubts can be used in order to pose a question. What did you mean by that? What did you mean by where you go, we know, and the way we know? What do you mean by that? What's the second lesson we learn from Thomas? The second lesson we learn from Thomas is that we can have doubt without living a fearful life. We can have doubt without living a fearful life. When that scene took place, when Jesus told them that they were going back to Bethany, they were going within 2 miles of where he had just been, where they had sought to stone him. John 11, verse 16 records, "Then Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" That's not the statement of an individual who fears. It's not a statement of an individual who fears. So again, can we simply say that a person can have a doubt or seek a clarification, but because someone might have doubt, it does not necessarily mean that a person has to live a fearful life. Now, don't get me wrong. There is doubt that kills faith. No question about that. But does doubt also mean that we have to live a fearful life? No, absolutely not. There's nothing in that statement that Thomas makes that let us go that we may die with him that would indicate fear. He knew where Bethany was. This was not like, I don't know where this is. He knew how close it was to the Pharisee stronghold of Jerusalem. He knew that they sought to kill Christ, and he knew that it was possible that if they caught up to him, that they, speaking of the disciples, could get caught up in that as well, and they could die as well. He knew that. He didn't doubt that. He knew those were possibilities. But he did not have a fear. He did not have a fear. Third lesson we learn from Thomas. I state it this way. Doubt is 1 foot in the air, poised to step forward or backward. Doubt is 1 foot in the air, poised to step forward or backward. This type of doubt we see from Thomas, not paralyzed, but rather affirming commitment to Jesus Christ. Here's what we read in John chapter 20, verses 27 and 28. Let me read it again. "Then he," speaking of Jesus Christ, "said to Thomas, 'Reach your hand here and look at my hands, and reach your hand here and put it in my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing.' And Thomas answered and said to him, 'My Lord and my God.'" Thomas had already heard what the disciples had said. He had not had benefit that they had had when Jesus looked in their eyes and said, "It's me. See the holes? See the holes? It's me." So here was the statement that they had made. He's got 1 foot in the air. Do I step backward saying, "Nah, it couldn't have been him"? Or do I step forward saying, "Yes, it is"? Doubt is 1 foot in the air. This type of doubt we see from Thomas, but he was not paralyzed. When Jesus makes that statement, what did he do? It was the step forward saying, "My Lord and my God." There's a quote. I'll share it with you. I don't know who it's attributed to. Statement goes like this: "Better to doubt out loud than disbelieve in silence." Better to doubt out loud than disbelieve in silence. Thomas was all in when he knew it was Jesus. His foot was in the air and he stepped forward, not backward. It's an interesting story. It's a story that speaks to the life of a disciple and an apostle that is not much spoken about in the pages of the Gospels. But in three scenes, we find that Thomas's story is short. It is concise. But what it also is very, very clear. Doubt can paralyze, but sometimes asking questions that some may consider doubtful is just getting clarification. It can lead us to changing our thinking rather than sitting in fear. Take a look at these three scenes from Thomas's life. I believe when we look at them, we can learn some very important lessons from the life of Thomas.